This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Today, a Food and Drug Administration scientist said Avandia, the popular diabetes pill, should be pulled from the market because of heart risks. While drugs like Avandia approved for sale by the FDA have to go through a long process of clinical trials before they're sold, those that are still being developed and studied in clinical trials are more risky. People looking for alternate treatments to what's already on the market often turn to clinical trials for access to developmental drugs. But what happens to the majority of patients who can't get into a clinical trial? And what if the person is terminally ill and desperate for treatment? Today we discuss the right of patients to access unapproved drugs. Later in the hour, we remember filmmaker Ingmar Bergman. But first, should terminally ill patients have access to developmental drugs? We want to hear from you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Frank Burrows. He's president of the Abigail Alliance for Better Access to Developmental Drugs. He joins us from his office in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's nice to be here.
Why did you start the Abigail Alliance?
It started because we couldn't get a cancer drug that for my daughter Abigail that was in clinical trials. She didn't qualify for the strict protocol of the clinical trial.
And ultimately, were you successful at getting access to the drug?
No, we weren't. Abigail died, and the drug was approved 4.5 years later for head and neck cancer that she had.
And what would you have hoped to have been able to do for Abigail? What was your goal?
Well, I think what we were trying to do for Abigail was to get her this cancer drug that had showed early efficacy and no known serious safety issues in clinical trials. As we later found out, it could have extended her life, saved or extended her life. After Abigail died, I continued to work on to help tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people by founding the Abigail Alliance.
And what do you say to people who say these phase one clinical trials are just too risky?
There's a quote on our website, which in our website is abigail-alliance.org. It's very interesting. Every drug for cancer and other serious life-threatening illnesses that the Abigail Alliance has pushed for earlier access to in our six-year history is now approved by the FDA. There's not one drug we push for that was rejected by the FDA. Currently, we're working with patients and have been working with patients and are very disappointed about the FDA decision regarding Provenge for prostate cancer and very saddened by the FDA decision, mostly Dr. Richard Pazdur, regarding Genesens, a drug by Genta Corporation for melanoma and CAL leukemia. What's happening is drugs that show early efficacy and no known serious safety issues are being denied these patients who can't get into clinical trials. It's a tragedy.
Frank Burrows, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Frank Burrows is president of the Abigail Alliance for Better Access to Developmental Drugs. He's been talking to us from his office in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Joining us now is Fran Miller. She's a professor of law at Boston University School of Law, and she's talking to us from member station WBUR in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the Abigail Alliance, we just heard from Mr. Burrows, is suing the FDA. Tell me what's at contest in that case.
Excuse me. The basic thing they're interested in establishing is a constitutional right of access to get experimental drugs.
And, a constitutional right? Which part of the Constitution?
It's constitutional due process right. It's one of those things that probably lay people would find obscure and arcane. But what it really means is for the FDA to restrict access to an experimental drug if the courts find, and as you know, the Abigail Alliance case has been re-argued and decision is pending in the D.C. Circuit on this issue, if they find a constitutional right of access, the FDA has a much stricter standard of scrutiny to meet in order to keep people from getting it. And it's really a question of how much evidence the FDA has to come up with that a particular drug in the clinical stages is dangerous, and how much they can basically interfere with the right of an individual to have access to it.
So take us briefly through how this lawsuit progressed. The original three-judge panel sided with the Abigail Alliance. The FDA asked the full panel to hear it, 10 judges.
Right. The district court dismissed it because prior precedent indicated there is no constitutional right of access to therapy. There's a constitutional right to refuse therapy, but not to get it. And the D.C. Circuit took a somewhat unexpected position in a 2-3 decision and found that there was a constitutional due process right. And the FDA petitioned for a rehearing, and that was granted. The decision was vacated, and the case was reheard on March 1st, and everyone's watching very carefully to see what the full bank of the D.C. Circuit will have to say on this issue.
Do you care to lay any odds?
Yes. I think they will reverse the prior D.C. Circuit holding on it.
And rule in favor of the FDA.
Yeah. See, I hate to put it that way.
Well, it's hard to understand reversing which level because it's gone back and forth so many times.
Right. Well, when you raise something to a constitutional level, you are in a whole new ball game. And people thought this issue had been laid to rest long ago with the Laetril cases and, again, with the physician-assisted suicide cases, which were basically about the same kind of thing, getting access to drugs in order to terminate life. And the Supreme Court was quite definitive in a pair of cases. They were saying, no, there is no such right of access.
Is this case likely to end up in the Supreme Court?
Well, certainly both sides. I have a strong stake in the positions they hold. It all depends on whether the Supreme Court, if it is appealed, whether the Supreme Court decides that this is the time, that this is a ripe time to go forward and decide the issue.
Let's hear from Charlotte in Charles City. Charlotte, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hello.
Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. I just was very interested in this subject because I have a brother-in-law who has soft tissue cancer. He's had it for over 5 years. The traditional treatments available, he has actually taken as many treatments, the maximum allowed for those. So he did get in an experimental treatment program, and I can't remember right now. I think it was Johnson & Johnson, and unfortunately, there were 6 out of 800 people taking this drug that had a particularly severe reaction. It was almost died. And because of that, of course, they had to terminate that particular treatment. Now he has tried getting treatment around us in Illinois and Minnesota and areas around us, and he's been rejected from all the experimental treatments now, either because of his age or the amount of chemo he's had. There's one last chance that we have in Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, that he may be able to get into. If he doesn't, then because these other drugs aren't accessible to him unless he's in a treatment, an experimental treatment, his treatments will be done. And at that point in time, they don't really expect him to last a long time. So we would love to see some of these drugs available, even though you're not within those trials.
Charlotte, thank you for your call. Thank you for sharing that story with us. Fran Miller, what sort of recourse does someone like Charlotte's brother have?
Well, I'd like to just go back a little bit. She talked about recourse to, this is his only recourse to treatment. And I think that's something that is quite common, that people think of a drug that is in a clinical trial as being treatment. But the whole point of a clinical trial is to figure out whether something does or doesn't work. And so to call it treatment is really an oxymoron. It's you're engaging in an experiment to see whether something works or doesn't work, and whether on balance the risks that attend taking it will justify whatever possible positive benefit can come out of it. So it's a question, it's a balancing question as to whether people fully understand. For example, the Abigail Alliance litigation said basically held that a mentally competent, the D.C. Circuit opinion, held that a mentally competent, terminally ill adult patient with no alternative FDA-approved treatment options could claim a substantive due process right of access to possibly life-sustaining experimental medications. Well, there are a lot of interesting slippery points in that holding. But to call it treatment is perhaps, you know, is very illusionary, because when you look at the statistics about what kind of drugs which are in phase 1 trials are the basic safety trials to determine the maximum safe dose of a drug before they go forward into any efficacy studies. If you're just talking about a drug that is in a phase one trial, 80% of products which are tested in phase one trials never go forward to market because they don't pan out on efficacy grounds.
I want to repeat that point because it's worth repeating. Phase one is more or less to test the dosage level of safety for phase two. It's not to measure whether or not the drug is effective.
That's right. And now they will not ignore incidental efficacy data if there is any that comes forward. But usually we're talking about testing on healthy patients just to find where the maximum safe dose is. When you're talking about cancer therapy, you're usually not doing that on healthy patients. But 80% of products which are tested in phase one trials will never get an FDA. So that means 80% of products that the Abigail Alliance litigation says you should be able to have access to are never going to pan out for you in terms of efficacy or reasonable efficacy and safety, and they may indeed diminish both the quality and the quantity of remaining life.
We're talking about experimental drugs and the world of clinical trials with Fran Miller, professor of law at Boston University. And we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK, or send us email at the address is talk@npr.org. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. Getting into a clinical trial can elicit many reactions. Some people mistrust unapproved drugs, while others who are terminally ill are desperate for alternate treatment. Who should get access to these drugs while they are still in the developmental stage? My guest is Fran Miller. She's a law professor at Boston University's School of Law. And of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Have you ever participated in a clinical trial or tried to get a family member some drugs that are not yet approved by the FDA? The number to call, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And check out our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Fran Miller, I wanted to ask you quickly about the so-called compassionate use exception for drugs that are not yet approved. How does that work?
The FDA has a procedure whereby you can, if you have a physician who knows about a clinical trial and is willing to sponsor you for it, can petition the FDA for permission to get the medication. You can't call it off-label because it hasn't gotten a label, it isn't being marketed yet, but outside the clinical trial and use it as and basically collect data. You won't be in a clinical trial. You won't be matched with controls the way a formal trial is handled. But it basically permits you to get it if you're willing, if you've got a physician who's willing to sponsor you, and you can go forward with it. And by and large, the FDA has been pretty liberal in granting that.
But it requires that the pharmaceutical company provide the medication.
It certainly does. And I'd like to just make one comment about the FDA here. We sort of have a love-hate relationship with the FDA. There are people who call it very paternalistic with respect to its drug approvals, and, you know, in some cases, perhaps it is. But they also fault it for not being more strict with medications like, for example, Vioxx. And so on the one hand, we're very much individuals when it comes to wanting something for ourselves. But on the other hand, when they don't pull something from the market, and certainly what went on with Vioxx is exhibit A with respect to this, and certainly what's happening today with respect to Avandia. There's certainly plenty of controversy over what the FDA Advisory Committee is going to do today in its decision.
But isn't the difference in these cases that terminally ill patients have a lot less to lose?
Well, certainly so. But do you know you're terminal when you're taking Vioxx? I don't even mean to prejudge the causal effect with respect to Merck and Vioxx. But, we're all terminal one way or another. But I take your point. Certainly, if you're willing to assume risks as you are terminally ill, the real question is how much do you understand about those risks? How much are you really told about them?
I want to bring Dr. Emil Freireich into this conversation. He's a distinguished professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. He's joining us from his office there. Welcome.
Hi.
You have sided with the Abigail Alliance on this issue. Why do you think patients should have access to developmental drugs?
Well, a patient who has a life-threatening illness is a person who is anxious to do whatever he can to make his remaining life pleasant. And therefore, there's no question in my mind that if a patient with a life-threatening illness would like to receive an investigational drug and his physician wants to prescribe it, that he should have access to it.
So your position is it's almost one of pity.
It's almost what?
One of pity.
Pity is not the right word. It's hope, I would say. When a patient is given a hopeless prognosis, they have several ways to get into a hopeful frame of mind. One is to turn to some quack remedy, which is frequently done. You know, you go see someone in Mexico who has a magic potion. Or you do something that is scientifically legitimate. You consult your physician, and he consults literature, or you get on the web and read everything that's known, and try to participate in some activity which gives you hope for a better outlook than you would otherwise have.
So why not just give them placebo?
Excuse me?
So why not just give them placebo and tell them they're getting the drug?
Well, because that's deceitful. And normally physicians don't deceive people or they wouldn't have faith in them. I think giving placebos is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I'm being
constitutional.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that as a valid concern. But if what you're saying is it helps people feel hope about their disease,
absolutely,
rather than necessarily cure their disease.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then the content of the pill isn't necessarily what's at issue.
Of course it is, because they will get hope from real knowledge. You mentioned a placebo. I mentioned quack drugs. You can get hope from those items. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about real hope based on real science and real professional recommendations from a professional, normally a physician. If a physician says drug X is in clinical trial and there have been excellent responses and there's a very good possibility that this will have an effect which cannot be accomplished with anything now available to you, I would recommend you do it.
Let's hear from Betty in San Francisco. Betty, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't disagree at all with what's been said. And the only comment that I would make is that oftentimes physicians really can't say that there's a very good hope. You know, many times these patients are patients who've seen lots of chemo drugs, and they really are at the end of the line. And as your speaker before pointed out, the vast majority of patients who go on phase 1 and phase 2 trials do not benefit from the drugs that they're on, either because they're just not efficacious or because they don't get the right dose or because they have resistant disease or, you know, some other reason like that. And I think that as I've, you know, gone along in my practice, the thing that I've come to realize is that my responsibility isn't so much getting people on trial, although I'm very pro-trial. I think that...
I'm sorry, Betty, are you an oncologist?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I think that what patients are often missing is an understanding of what the balance of the choices that they're making when they go on trial. I mean, you know, what somebody said before is that there's nothing to lose. Well, that's actually not true. There's actually quite a bit to lose. There's
sure.
a lot to be lost in terms of quality of life from a useless drug that has side effects. There's time, energy, money, sure. You know, time that could be spent with loved ones, getting, you know, things together, spending quality time, doing things that make people happy. Instead, they're running around from medical center to medical center doing tests that are required for the clinical trial.
Sure.
And also there's a, you know, price and hope. It is a gamble, and it takes, you know, it's going to occupy your mental energy. You're going to put a lot of hope in that. It's not that hope is a bad thing. It's just that if all of your hope at the end of your life is focused on this one thing and not on something else, you know, that it doesn't have to do with the treatment, but on, you know, just your quality of life.
Do I get
it? I think that often it's not. It doesn't end up being a very good bargain for the patient.
Right. Betty, thanks for your call. Emil Freireich? Dr. Freireich?
It's a sad thing that many medical oncologists talk the way this particular physician did. I'm talking about a decision that is made by an informed, intelligent physician, usually a physician scientist, who's recommending a choice which is better than the available choices, in his esteem. As I've pointed out before in many venues, the decision of what a patient is willing to do should be made by the patient and his physician, particularly a physician scientist. I think, as this physician pointed out, when you go to a medical center, you're dealing with real experts in the treatment of the disease. And those experts have knowledge about the drugs and their potential. And if they have a recommendation that a drug has potential for that patient, and that patient doesn't qualify for the clinical trials for whatever reason, I think it's a constitutional right for that person to be able to follow his physician's advice. And remember that you want to put the decision in the hands of the person best qualified. At the present time, the people who are deciding who should get these drugs are FDA officials, who are certainly not the best qualified.
And you don't think that the compassionate use exemption is enough?
Oh, it's rare.
It's
never used.
Yeah.
When you ask for compassion for the FDA, we had a session with the FDA at our hospital where they told us, frankly, we never approve it. I mean, that mechanism is there, but it's never to the FDA officials' advantage to approve a compassionate use. I've quoted an article I wrote from Milton Friedman that an FDA official has two very different kinds of mistakes. One, approve a drug that turns out to have unanticipated side effects resulting in death or impairment, or refuse approval that is capable of saving many lives. With visions of thalidomide in their head, the knowledge of the fame and acclaim that came to the woman who upheld the approval of thalidomide, is there any doubt which mistake you will be more anxious to avoid? With the best will in the world, you'll be led to reject or postpone, and that's exactly what happens when the decision's in the hands of the FDA, compassionate or other use. Everything leads the FDA official to postpone or reject. And that's what happens.
Dr. Freireich, thanks so much for joining us. Dr. Emil Freireich is director of the Adult Leukemia Research Program at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. He's been talking to us from MD Anderson Cancer Center studios in Houston. We have an email from Stuart in Salt Lake City who says, "While I'm no expert on being a cancer survivor, I've been living with HIV for over 14 years. I remember well the fight we had to get experimental HIV medication on the fast track for public release. We were successful in that fight, and the result has been overwhelmingly positive. The argument against releasing those drugs was that we did not know the long-term side effects. I was one of a small group of people who did suffer from serious and unanticipated side effects. I was unable to work for 3 years as a result. In spite of that awful experience, I certainly think it was better than the alternative, death." My guest is Fran Miller, professor of law at Boston University School of Law. And I'm also joined now by Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I should make it clear that you are not speaking on behalf of NIH in any way. You are here speaking from your own point of view. And what is that point of view? For these people that are terminally ill, why shouldn't they have a right to these medications?
Well, First of all, I think we should separate out the issue of the constitutional right from what good public policy is. I think, as Fran Miller correctly pointed out, the Supreme Court has said in its end-of-life care cases and its physician-assisted suicide cases that the liberty interest people have, the fundamental constitutional right, is not to be invaded, not to have their body invaded. That's a much different item than to be able to demand medications or resources. As a matter of fact, more than 25 years ago, the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research made that point, that the ability to refuse is one thing, but even autonomy and self-determination does not give a patient rights to demand the use of resources, including drugs. So that's been a long-standing view. And I think, as Professor Miller said, the D.C. Appellate Court's decision, which was 2-1, was kind of what observers of the court have called a twistification of the judgment of the Supreme Court in the physician-assisted suicide cases to try to get it to fit their own ideological position, and it didn't fit. The second issue is, should once we say that there's no constitutional right, the question is, in any individual case, should a patient get access to drugs? And everyone has said, the FDA and others, including myself, that patients should, under some circumstances, be able to get access to unapproved drugs. That's the compassionate use item. And contrary to Dr. Friedreich, who said that it's never used, that's simply untrue. As a matter of fact, probably the biggest case of compassionate use was with the drug Erisa, which was developed by AstraZeneca for lung cancer. And while there were some promising results, it actually made access available to 24,000 people worldwide. But then it was shown not to have any survival benefit in lung cancer, even after many, many people got access to this drug. So it's simply not true that the FDA doesn't use this mechanism.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
I'd like to echo what Dr. Emanuel just said. I was racking my brain for the numbers, but I was at a conference, a Food and Drug Law Institute conference on the Abigail Alliance a few months ago, and the FDA official there, and I cannot remember the numbers, but if I remember correctly, they said about 75% of their, or to 80% of their petitions for compassionate use are granted. And I think perhaps Dr. Fabrique was sort of conflating the basic approval decision of a drug with the compassionate use separate issue. The FDA does indeed often take its time with respect to being sure before granting an NDA, which basically lets a drug go to market. But if I remember correctly, it's more than 75% of their petitions for compassionate use are granted.
And Dr. Emanuel, if a patient is terminal, understands the risk, is willing to assume them, and either the pharmaceutical company isn't offering the compassionate use or there's some other roadblock to that, why not allow them access?
Look, there is a very important balance here. When you have a patient in front of you, a terminally ill patient, your heart goes out to them. You're feeling very compassionate. You want to do everything you can for them. You'd be a brute, a robot, if you didn't feel for them and their situation and their family situation. On the other hand, we also have to recognize that there's important social policy here. We have had drugs. You mentioned Avandia. Vioxx has been mentioned. But before the FDA existed, we had lots of drugs that harmed people and that hurt people, first of all. Second of all, the most important thing for cancer patients is not access to experimental drugs. It's access to proven drugs that actually fight cancer. And the only way we're going to know if they're proven is if we do clinical trials. And we have a lot of experience that early access to drugs delays clinical trial and delays our knowledge of whether drugs work or don't. In the cancer field, we have this information from the bone marrow transplant experience, where lots of people thought bone marrow transplant was the cure to breast cancer, the metastatic breast cancer. They advocated that insurance companies cover it. They advocated state legislatures often mandated that it be paid for. And the data are that about 25,000 to 40,000 women got bone marrow transplantation off protocol, so no data was collected from them. And we barely were able to enroll 1,000 women in the trial that showed that it had no benefit at all, that, in fact, all those women were getting this extra high dose, some of them dying in the bone marrow transplant room for no benefit. And we've had that experience with AIDS drugs also.
Coming up, more of your calls on unapproved drugs, and we'll remember the director of Fanny Alexander and the Seventh Seal. Filmmaker Ingmar Bergman died today at the age of 89. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about access to experimental drugs. My guests are Fran Miller, professor of law at Boston University Law School, and Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Bioethics for the Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's take a phone call. This is Hank in San Francisco. Hank, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hello. I'd like to share my experience. I'm a person with AIDS. I was the first person to get one of the drugs. It was a situation where I was had exhausted the treatments. They weren't working. I had had bad side effects with the ones that were available. And I petitioned to get in, or I tried to get into a clinical trial. I wasn't qualified, but I petitioned to still get access to the drug, and I got it. And now it's state-of-the-art medicine. When I took that drug, we had a lot of risk. We didn't know exactly what was going to happen. It had never been in humans before, but it was very important for me personally. I had only 26 T cells. I had been in the hospital with a bad brain infection for a week. My weight was just incredibly, incredibly low, and it gave me hope. It also had a benefit for society. When we take these experimental drugs, even though we're not in a clinical trial, we get information about side effects. Those can be collected by the FDA. If the FDA was doing a better job in collecting side effect information, everyone would be at a whole different level than we are right now. So there's an individual benefit. There's also a societal benefit. In terms of lung cancer, which I also have, and I just learned that I have that in the last few months, I'm on an internet site with thousands of people with lung cancer, and it's very, very sad to see people that have exhausted all treatments that are currently available. And they're aware of other treatments, and they would gladly participate in those clinical trials, and they can't get in them because they're filled, and they're in a waiting pattern, and that waiting pattern can be many, many months and sometimes years. And to read those stories about the people that would travel all the way across the country, they'd stay in trailers, they'd stay on a floor in a sleeping bag, and they're aware of drugs that are out there, and other people that are taking those drugs are sharing their information, and we know that those drugs are hopeful. They just haven't gone through the, quote, process yet.
Hank, thank you so much for your call.
Actually, I think Hank's story about his AIDS treatment shows you that the system works, that when someone isn't eligible for a clinical trial and does petition, the FDA is responsive and you can get access. But I think we should also be clear that that Hank's drug turned out to be state-of-the-art and to be successful is the minority of cases.
You wanted to clarify just how much of a minority, by the way. Your number was 95% of
phase one drugs. Well, if you look at the 100 drugs that start in human trials, that's phase one trials, to find out dosage, only five will get to FDA approval. Only 70 out of those 100 will even go on to test for efficacy. 30 fail because they're too toxic or for some other reason. And even of those that go on, pass phase one, only 1 in 12 will get approval. So most of the drugs, 11 of those drugs, are going to fail, and only one's going to succeed. And we have to recognize that many of those patients who get those other drugs will not get any benefit and may get harm. And I might add, what you collect, the information you collect on compassionate use, is nowhere near as valuable as the information collected on a clinical trial.
I want to just add something to what Dr. Emanuel is saying there. The bottleneck here is really not the FDA. It's the manufacturers. They want patients in clinical trials so that they can get the safety and efficacy evidence that they need in order to go to market. They don't want patients who have comorbidities or too sick or otherwise don't qualify for the trial, distorting their data on safety and efficacy. They're the ones, and certainly the Penelope case, which was widely read about after the Wall Street Journal front page article on it, was about a manufacturer that didn't want to take the risk of having its clinical trials torpedoed by using it. And it's just tragic facts with respect to a little girl who was dying. of, I believe it was leukemia, but even
if the data from terminal patients who have access to these drugs through compassionate use or some other channel isn't as valuable as a, you know, random double-blind clinical trial, isn't all information helpful to some degree? Hank's point about side effects, even if it wasn't efficacy?
Well, that's certainly true.
It can be valuable, usually not alone, but collected with others. And actually, again, this is one of the reasons manufacturers might be hesitant. Mostly, if you get side effects, it tends to rule against the drug, not in favor of the drug. Let me make another point about cancer clinical trials, which is an area I've worked on a lot. Mostly, it's not that clinical trials are full up and people are waiting to enroll in them. Mostly, we have clinical trials open and they're not enrolling patients. The notion that Hank said that we have hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of people willing to enroll in clinical trials just is not the reality out there. About 40 to 60,000 cancer patients a year enroll in clinical trials. We have many clinical trials which have been open which aren't enrolling patients, where it's difficult to enroll patients. And so the idea here that patients are just waiting for clinical trials is, I think, not an accurate picture out there. The second thing I would say, and reemphasize a point I made before, is that if you have these alternative mechanisms which are easily available and patients don't have to go into a clinical trial, we know from history, from the bone marrow transplant cases and others, that patients will not go into a clinical trial and go into this alternative mechanism, making it harder to enroll people in a clinical trial, harder to get the data to know whether a drug works or doesn't work, and harder to get proven stuff out to patients. If we slow up the system, slowing up the enrollment in clinical trials, we're actually going to make it worse for cancer patients, not better, because we won't know whether these drugs work. It will take many more years to learn their efficacy and their side effects and then present the data to the FDA about the balance. So in point of fact, cancer patients, and again, contrary to what Dr. Friedreich and the Abigail Alliance has suggested, most cancer advocacy groups, or many cancer advocacy groups, are actually against a constitutional right to investigational treatments. They like the process because we learn faster whether drugs work or don't work, and we can move on when they don't work.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is the chair of the Department of Bioethics for the Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health. He's been joining us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Fran Miller, professor of law at Boston University School of Law. She's been talking to us from member station WBUR in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you, too.